Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
All right, hello. Hey, Dad, how you doing?
Hey, Kay, doing good. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Did you have anything good to drink this week?
Well, I did have a different beer that I had not come across before. I was looking around for something different. I go through my streaks where I just drink Guinness, and then usually I start looking for something lighter, like a wheat-type beer. And I found this Belgian beer that I have never heard of before. And I thought, well, I'll try that. So I got that, and it was very good.
What was it called?
Well, I wish I could remember. I don't remember, but it was good.
It was delicious and fantastic, and everyone should try it. Who knows what it was?
It had a blue label on it and kind of a little castle emblem or something. It was a Hofbräu or something like that.
Oh.
But it was good.
Was it from the Hofbräu house?
I guess. I don't know. But it was good, whatever it was. But I had several of those while I watched Marshall go down in flames.
I'm sorry to hear that happened, but
yeah. And then on top of that, fall is falling, so we've been getting rain and cold weather here.
Yeah, we had rain all weekend. Do you know it's rained? What was it? 14 of the last 19 weekends in New York.
Really?
Yeah.
Man,
it's like clockwork. And I'll tell you, working in the restaurant industry, you know, you make your money on Friday, Saturday, part of Sunday. That's kind of it. Like, you can do okay on the weekdays, but that's when you make your money. And we were all just talking about it, like how much like it sucks to be hit every weekend with something that's gonna statistically cut your business in half.
Oh, really? People don't go out as much if it's raining?
No, not at all. And I mean,
really? I would figure as long as you're indoors, it'd be all right. But
no,
I guess
people don't go out as much. Like if you work at a place that has delivery, like you might equal it out. You know, one of the other jobs I had for a while, it was equal parts kind of walk up and delivery. So on the rainy nights, we do a lot more delivery, but we do a lot less walk ups. But this place, like we have outdoor seating. So we lose a third of our dining room when it rains just to rain. And then also foot traffic. You don't have people coming in, you know. People don't want to be out wandering around. I don't want to go out wandering around. Like if it is raining and cold on a night in New York and I'm off, you're really going to have to offer me something special to make me go out and brave the storm. I would always rather be inside. So I don't blame the people that don't come out, but it sucks.
Yeah. Also in New York, you do a lot more walking around. Whereas here, you know, you drive up almost to the place and park right outside and go running in. So
that's true.
It's a lot of different what you're doing there. Your transportation is foot transportation.
Well, especially now that New York floods every time it sprinkles, it's like, I don't know. There's a whisper of rain and half the trains go down. So it's like, I can't go anywhere. I can't do anything.
Stay home and order food.
Yeah. Well, I don't even do that because it's like, then I have to make some poor guy come out on his bicycle in the pouring rain and bring me food.
Yeah, that's all right. That poor guy's not getting paid if he's not bringing somebody food.
Yeah, but it's just like, you know, the amount that I feel like I need to tip him to justify it is not something I can afford, so I just won't do it. So.
Oh, I feel like you're doing him a favor. Otherwise, he'd just be sitting there doing nothing.
Well, it depends. It depends on the hourly. But yeah, we got fall all up and down the East Coast this week.
Yep. The leaves are turning and falling.
Oh. I did not have anything fun to drink this week. I don't know. I've been working so much, and it's the second week of my new menu. And, I forget, it's been a while. You know, I ran a program at my old bar for 5 years, And then I had a 3-year hiatus during COVID where I could not work in a bar. And now I'm back at the helm of a program. And I forget how terrifying it is every time somebody orders a drink that you created. And you have to sit there and hope that they don't hate it.
It's like them not thinking your baby's cute, huh?
It is. It is. And like, don't get me wrong, the new menu is going over really well. But like, I just, I forgot. Like, oh, yeah, I put up a couple drinks. You know, the managers say they like it. My coworkers like it. That's all that matters. And then it's like, no, 100 times a night, I got to watch somebody's reaction to something that I made with my hands and cared a lot about.
Yeah.
So I've had a lot of my menu cocktails this week, like testing them, making sure everybody, we've got a lot of new batches, a lot of new recipes in the house. You know, it's a lot of just like making sure everybody's keeping up with things correctly. That's kind of been it. Other than that,
well, that'll keep you busy tasting 9 or 11 drinks or whatever it is.
Yeah. It's always funny just seeing the ones that like out of the gate don't do well, and then they start to catch on, and you know, it's like, okay, yeah, that was a weirdo, but now people love it. Like it's a fun journey.
You just have to have a special for something, you know, each night on the different ones to get people to try it. A lot of times just a question, get somebody to try it or breaking what they think it might. For some reason, they think, oh, that's probably like this. So I wouldn't like that. So,
I mean, it's interesting because it's a funny math you have to do. Because think of it this way. There's a certain type of drink you can make that everybody will probably be unoffended consuming, right? I would put it kind of in the realm of like a Tom Collins, which is basically alcoholic lemonade. No one's upset when they're served that. No one's upset with something that's a little sweet, a little tart, a little boozy, refreshing. No one's going to be bothered by that. And you could put a whole menu of those kind of drinks up and it wouldn't necessarily sell well, but no one would be offended by it. But the person that's going to want an inoffensive drink is not going to, or there's only so many of those people, and you're going to max out your audience for that. So you kind of have to have the oddballs on the menu. You have to have the things that maybe not everyone wants, but you've got to find the right balance of like things that everybody wants and also catch those people that are going to be bored by what everybody wants, or catch those people that are going to want strong or bitter or, you know, like more nuanced drinks. I don't know. It's just a funny thought process to go through. Like, did I put a good balance of cheerleaders and weirdos on this menu? Everyone's going to have something to relate to. It's hard to say. But
I know you're working at it, though. You're working at it good.
And this today's episode was inspired by one of the weirdos that's actually been doing pretty good. You know, I inherited this bar program from a very, very skilled, smart lady who was running it before me. She left the business for, I don't know, however long, because she had a baby. Congratulations for that. I just sort of inherited all the bones of it. And part of that is what I think every bar manager has, which is a weird, dusty corner in the basement full of experimental bottles, like samples, gifts, infusions that failed. So I've started to go through that as I'm developing menus. Like, it makes sense to use what she left behind for me because I have not made enough contacts there to have my own dusty corner yet. So when I was working on the new menu, there was one bottle that caught my eye because I had heard of it. I kind of understood what it was, but I'd never tasted it before. And that was Kümmel, which is, I knew it was like a coriander or cumin kind of flavored liqueur. And that's about all I knew. So I brought it up. I was struggling with putting a fun fall twist on a Negroni, and I was like, maybe this will work. I think it tastes like bread. Bread sounds like fall. Let's do that.
Well, I've never heard of it, period. That was completely new to me. That I never even knew it existed.
Well, this was, I would say as far as I knew that maybe it existed, but I'd never worked with it before. So I, you know, broke it out, started playing around with it, throwing in a couple different drinks. It worked out really well in one of the sort of Negroni play I put on the menu. In a very small quantity because it's very aggressive. But I thought now that I'm working with it, I need to know everything about it. So let's learn everything we can about Kümmel.
Kimmel. Not Jimmy Kimmel.
No, not Jimmy Kimmel. It's Kimmel.
Okay.
And we'll start with functionally. What is it? So it is a caraway cumin flavored liqueur. So it's sweet. It's generally a little bit lower ABV. It has like the one I have is like 20%. So like 40 proof. And that's fairly standard. I think to sort of start with, I keep saying caraway and cumin. And there's some confusion there about what it's based in. So maybe that's the first sort of confusing wrinkle we should iron out as far as what goes into this product.
Yeah, cumin and caraway.
So ostensibly, they look very similar, and they can be used as replacements for each other in recipes because they do share a lot of flavor notes, right? Like caraway seeds, cumin seeds, they're small, they're little kind of little curvy, like moon-shaped guys. I don't know, like it's little seeds. One's darker than the other, one's slightly bigger than the other. They have an earthy flavor, they have an aromatic quality, and they can bring a lot of the same notes to a recipe, but they do have distinct origins and distinct uses. So cumin, usage of it goes back to ancient Iran and the Mediterranean. It popped up in Egyptian mummification rituals. Sanskrit, it meant like healing for the digestive system, so it was used in a lot of medications. And caraway is just as old, if not older. It dates back to the Stone Age. It specifically originated in Southern Europe. So it was used a lot by the Greeks and the Romans as like an appetite stimulant. It was later used by the Germans to ward off witches. I don't know, sure. But so slightly different areas of origin.
Yeah, the one I read said that it had a very calmative effect, reducing flatulence and that bloated feeling that you experienced after a heavy meal.
Yes, yes. Well, I think both kind of have that quality of like a digestive balm. And like
once flavor- again, a liquor housed as a medicinal purpose, huh?
This seems to be the one thing that the ones that actually work have in common. For digestion, yes, we have conclusive evidence that certain qualities in flavors can aid your digestion, stimulate your juices. So this is that wheelhouse. Flavor-wise, cumin is sort of warmer and earthier, a touch savory, while caraway has that distinct sort of licorice pungent note that we think of when we think of like anise or fennel. But they do, part of the confusion for what is the base of Kamel and like why they're kind of looked at as synonymous is really in like the places that Kamel originated in, and the words they use for these two seeds are very similar. Let's start in Scandinavia. Caraway is cumin, while cumin is spitzkumin. In Romania, cimin is caraway, and simian is cumin. And in Germany, Kamel specifically means caraway, but Kreuzkamel is cumin. So clearly, a lot of people a long time ago thought these things are pretty similar.
Well, I hope you all took notes because there will be a quiz on this later.
Well, look, I probably butchered all those pronunciations. I'm sorry to everybody in all of those countries. But my point is, they all sound kind of similar because clearly people thought they taste kind of similar. And they do. Even though they have distinct qualities, they do taste kind of similar. They look similar,
so too. People probably kind of look at them as almost like they're interchangeable.
Well, and I mean, even now, like in modern baking, you'll have people say, like, if you can't find caraway, you can use this many cumin seeds. You know, that's something that has enough similar properties that they're not the same, but they are used closely. Mm-hmm. And that obviously plays into why ancient people who thought they tasted similar also, when they were trying to make a liqueur with them, said, throw a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's fine. It's all kind of the same.
It needs one or the other, so put both in.
Yeah, that was the answer. although when we go back to antiquity, like when we're talking about the origin of Kamel, it started out as a cumin liqueur. So the first people to ever claim to professionally make it, to market it for the public, those were the Dutch company Bols, which we talked about before. Bols is a big company, still making a ton of liqueurs to this day. But back in 1575, when they were founded, in all of their large swath of flavors they offered a cumin liqueur that they dubbed Kümmel. And it was used mainly as a, that kind of you're talking about, like as a tonic for colic, for babies, and also for digestive issues.
If your baby some liquor, that'll help calm it down.
Yeah, just get a little bit. It's liqueur. It's not liquor. Just a little bit in there. It's fine. Dad, this was back in the days we were rubbing like cocaine on baby's gums. All right. We're not. We're fine. This is better.
Okay. All right.
De Cooper's, which you've probably heard of, they're another like kind of nowadays, I think it's viewed as like a cheap liqueur brand, but they also had, they were Dutch founded and they released a cumin distillate in like the mid 1600s. But the person to really be involved, this, I love when a random historical figure pops up and you're like, oh, that's why we drink this thing. Because this person, Peter the Great, was living in the Netherlands in 1696 under an assumed name specifically to gain shipbuilding knowledge.
Yeah, the assumed name was Peter the Okay.
Yeah, sure. So Peter the not the Peter the Okay
not so was, great.
Peter the not so great. Peter the Okay was in the Netherlands. He had some Kümmel. And he was so enamored with it that he specifically went to the Bols distillery to learn their secrets so that when he returned to Russia as, surprise, that was Peter the Great all along, he spread the gospel. Now, he spread its popularity, wanted people to start making it, started importing it, and it caught on in Russia in a big way for the next century or so. But it really hit its stride in 1823 when Wilhelm von Blankenhagen, who was a baron in Russia, he opened the Alsak distillery in Riga, which was part of the Russian Empire. I believe it's now modern day Latvia, but he opened this distillery to distill a few things, but specifically to distill Kümmel. He's a big fan. It was popular. Somebody had to fill the need. And he had a family recipe. So his family had been making it for a long time just for themselves. This was his family recipe, and this is the first time that we get on record a mixture of cumin and caraway. So it was a sugar beet-based distillate, which we know sugar beets, that's just how you get your sugar that you ferment into booze. That doesn't provide a lot of flavor. But the flavor profile specifically was both cumin and caraway, which is a departure from what we had from the Dutch. And Wilhelm, he wanted his spirit to go big. So he approached a merchant in 1850, a man by the name of Ludwig Mentendorf, to help represent and import his brand to Britain. Now, Ludwig was a smart guy. He agreed to do this, but only if his name could also be on the label. So by the 1850s, so he set up operations. He started selling this stuff in Britain. And by the 1850s, like, it was so popular that it rivaled gin. And specifically
That's hard to believe.
It is. The British, they love their gin. But for this brief period of time, they also really loved their Kümmel. Specifically because it was viewed as, like you said, like it had more like digestive, like help relieve bloating. Like this was an element that gin didn't offer. So that was a reason that it was sort of superior. So caught on big time. It was a very big, like the height, I'd say, of the popularity of Kümmel was in this time period, like late 1800s, early 1900s.
Well, also, it probably, I mean, even though it rivaled gin, it was much more aromatic. I mean, gin isn't very aromatic or anything. So, you know, something like that would really catch you, I think, when you go to drink it.
It would have been a little lower alcohol, possibly, not necessarily, but definitely a different, you know, very different experience than gin. And of course, if it caught on in the UK, this is the same time period as really the boon of the American bartending scene, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s. This is when a lot of our classics are being born. A lot of our first generation of famous mixologists are stepping up to the plate. Naturally, Kamal found its way behind American bars and into the hands of American mixologists. A couple staples in that time period. We talked about Harry Johnson before. Harry Johnson was a big fan of Kamal. He put it into some punches. Willie Schmidt, another classic American bartender of the time period, he whipped it up into some martini plays. And both of them agreed that it was a spirit that you needed to have in a well-stocked bar, that sentiment isn't around today. Like, it's still a weirdo. Yeah. A lot of times we talk about spirits that have had a resurgence. This is not that. This is still kind of a weirdo.
I would just about guarantee you walk into 10 bars and ask for something with that, and at least 9 of them are going to say, huh?
Yeah. Oh, it's a very niche ingredient still to this day. But it had this little window of a heyday, late 1800s, early 1900s. Now, it did take a big blow in 1905 in one way, in that the Russian Revolution happened and the Baron's mansion and distillery was burnt to the ground and shuttered. Now Ludwig Menzendorf, he was a smart guy.
So Ludwig von Duck?
Different Ludwig?
Different Ludwig? Oh, okay.
Menzendorf, who was the one who launched it in the UK, he took the product. He just relocated the production. At that point, his name was on the label. He could say it was his product. So he relocated his production of it to France, specifically to what is now the Combier distillery, the Combier brand, which is a massive brand. And it's still made. His recipe is still made by the Combier brand. Incidentally, that's the dusty bottle that I pulled out of the basement when I was working on my new menu. Yeah? It's the Combier brand Kummel. So this is dating back to that Menzendorf brand that dates back to the Baron, that first Russian guy to make it big. But they weren't the only ones that really kept up the tradition. A lot of Russians relocated to Germany and kept making Kummel, and created a very, like, there's still like a love and a demand for it in Germany because of this. And they also kind of kept alive a very specific type of Kummel called Alsacht, which is named after that area that the distillery was originally on. And it's less of like a sister spirit to Kummel as it is a variety of it, I'd say, because it still has that coriander, caraway, cumin flavor profile. It just has a lot of like nuttiness added to it, almond and orange specifically flavors added to it. So it's just like a softer, sweeter varietal that caught on big in Germany. So you'll see that is like sometimes listed as a similar product to Kummel, sometimes as a sister product. It's really just a varietal. There were no hard rules on this product, so you could kind of infuse it with everything. And the version that was infused with orange and almond caught on big in Germany.
Hmm. Well, another thing that got Kummel big in the UK was that it was said that it was stocked in golf clubs, the bars at golf courses, because of the ability of this drink to calm your nerves. So they used to call it a putting mixture because apparently it would make you calm and increase your putting ability. Although usually liquor, for me, it has a as I start, I get better, but then I reach a certain peak where then I'm getting worse. That's what it was popular. They stocked it at all the golf courses to have as a nerve calmer.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely like, throughout, obviously in America, we run into prohibition very beloved, well-known spirits took a hit. So of course, something that's kind of niche like Kummel is going to disappear. Like, it was all but a whisper in American bars up until recently, and even now it's still a bit of a weirdo. But in the UK and Europe, like, it carried on. Russia still produces a lot of it. Germany still has a love for it. But yeah, in the UK, it's really golf clubs that carried on with it, with this idea that it's good for golfers. It really became big in the 1930s, and also across like Scottish clubs became a very big, like, popular thing. And it still has that association with it. So,
yeah. Well, I kind of feel like that this was like that region that it came out of. It was their version of like Ouzo or Iraq or something like that, because that's kind of what they did. And it was all a digestif and, you know, a sipping thing, not real high alcohol and stuff like that. And it kind of seems to fit that kind of a drink.
It's funny that we have, it's all throughout the world, really, that we have some spirit pop up that kind of has that vaguely licorice like quality to it, usually mm-hmm. high octane, but has a little bit of a licorice, a little bit of that flair to it. And it's a staple that's just consumed either neat or slightly modified. I guess at this point you can find one almost across the entire world. You know, you've got Agua Ardiente, you've got Ouzo, you've got Iraq, you've got Rocky, you've got like Kumul kind of fits in. It does have higher octane versions of it abroad. You know, the ones we usually get here are the liqueurs, but you will find higher proof versions. So I don't know. It's interesting. I think it's cool when the whole world does something independent of itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And regional taste or regional products that are there that make it change a little bit, change the product some, because that's what's available or that's what that area taste is or something like that. So it really personalizes it to where you're at, you know, and maybe that's why it becomes so popular on a national level with different groups, because you take pride in something that is basically, you know, from your homeland.
It's a universal idea, but it's tailored to your specific identity. It's like meat on a stick, right? Every culture has put meat on a stick, but what meat and how you put it on a stick is different.
So it's something we got the corn dog.
We all thought it was a good idea, but we all did it a little differently. I love those things. And I guess anise or fennel or, you know, caraway, something in this flavor profile with bay spirit is a thing. We all did, just very differently.
Yeah, that's right.
So there you go. There's Kumul. I feel like I've pronounced it 20 different ways throughout this episode because I'm still just like not like I say it and like that's fine. But it's a fun spirit. It's not that expensive a bottle. I bought the Cambier one. It's like $35-$40 retail. I will say, and this is always something that I want to clarify, some spirits are for everybody. Some spirits are not. I think this falls into more on the side of not, because it is.
Oh yeah.
It's very aggressively cumin and caraway. And if you don't like those flavors, you won't like this spirit. It's not a Saint Germain. It's not an orange liqueur. Like it's not a people pleaser. But if you want something that's going to add some breadiness and some earthiness and a little bit of warmth and a little bit of that weird licorice flavor to a beverage, this is perfect.
All right. Well,
I mean, I put a quarter ounce into my current drink, so it's a big drink. It's a 3 ounce pour of liquor, and a quarter ounce of that is the Kumul, and it comes through very pungently.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I doubt I can find it around here, but I will look.
Yeah, it might be hard to find. You could probably, I feel like it's something you could make a version of, you know. You get some grain neutral spirit, like an Everclear or something. You get some caraway and cumin seeds and some, you know, sweeten it with some sugar. You get close.
Well, all right. That sounds like something I'll have to look into.
There you go. If you want to taste something that Peter the Great went in disguise to experience. That's not why he did it, but we're going to say he did it for that reason.
Peter the not so great.
Definitely not Peter the not so good.
There was a guy here before him. He looked just like him, but his name was different. He wasn't such a braggart.
It was definitely not. It was Peter the something, not the great. He wasn't that great. yeah.
Peter the mediocre.
Oh, mediocre Pete. He loves his Kumul. All right. Well, thank you for this weird sort of, you know, it's fun to talk about a spirit. Like, I feel like a lot of spirits we talk about are kind of in their heyday. And this is one that I think it could still have one. You know, I was reading an article about how to use it in cocktails, and someone said it's not for your everyday bartenders. It's for your directional bartenders. And I'm still trying to sit on what does directional bartending mean? But I guess I get it. It's kind of what we talked about at the beginning. Like, I made the drink that makes everybody happy. Now I need to make the drink that makes weirdos happy. That's a choice, I guess. Is that a direction? Am I a directional bartender?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. You know, weirdos get thirsty too.
I mean, it's I call it the Tony Negroni, which people love saying. They love ordering it. Sometimes you just put a good name on something and you're like, a Tony Negroni? Yeah. It's fun to say. Say it three times. But that's what I write. I was surprised. I'm just going to see how this, you know, this weird thing works. And it worked. And that's all thanks to the Kamal. It was the final note. I already had kind of a weird recipe, and I was like, I need something. And this was it. So thank you to people that make Kamal for the past 500 years.
A Tony Negroni, huh?
Yeah.
You ought to have a picture of it of Tony the Tiger holding up one of them.
Well, you know, I made it as sort of an homage, because the Negroni, we talked about this, was Anthony Bourdain's favorite drink, and Anthony Bourdain also went by Tony. So I was like, it's a very worldly Negroni. It's a Negroni that's infused by a lot of spirits from all around the world. So I felt like that kind of made sense for him. That being said, I think that if I ever had the opportunity to make the man a Negroni, I just would have made him a regular ass Negroni. I would not have dared to say, let me show you my fun new spin. I don't think he would have appreciated that. That's fine. I can still honor him with this drink.
All right. I'm sure he's honored that he was thought of in the making of it.
Well, who knows? But there you go. If you happen across a dusty bottle of Kamel, try it out. It's a fun, deeply historical spirit. That plays a part in a weird collective unconscious of a desire to make anise, fennel, caraway flavored booze. So check it out.
And it'll reduce your flatulence, so people will like that. You better.
Yeah. If you drink too much gin, have you tried?
Yeah.
I don't think it'll make you fart less. All right.
Wikipedia said it would.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Wikipedia says lots of things. Well, thank you, Dad, for being here.
Well, thank you, Tay, for having me. I always learned something, and like that, I did.
Maybe you need some Kamal. I'm not going to say why, but maybe, you know, reasons. Thank you all for joining us.
I just get accused a lot.
If you want to find us on the internet, you can email us at meettheboozecast@gmail.com. You can also check out our Patreon. If you want to help support us, and if you want to talk about your favorite flatulent reducing alcohol, you can do that.
That Meet the Boozecast group page on Facebook.
Go there,
do that. Right there, discussing all things fart.
Okay, sure. Yeah, why not? Go for it. All right. Hey, thanks again. I've been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been
idea of what it is going in.
It's a fun spirit. It's a weirdo. I don't think it's ever going to make it big, but it's good.
Well, it's the Bob Uecker of liquor.
I don't know who Bob Uecker is.
He's an old-time baseball player and announcer.